Hello, Neil here. The following programme was recorded live at Fujifilm's House of Photography in London on the 2nd of March 2024, in front of an audience attending our Fujicast event. Unfortunately, Kevin, my other half, in terms of the podcast, was taken ill on the morning of the show and so was unable to attend. The good news is he's much better now and he's back, quite literally, on his feet. Of course, that didn't stop us on the day gently teasing the chap, as he said he completely expected.
Usually at this point, I would say something like, Kev! But there is no Kev, which is really unusual. I think in 3 years of presenting the programme, there were a few moments during COVID where I presented it myself. But apart from that, Kev's always been at my side. So today, we have enrolled a far more educated, erudite man when it comes to knowing about Fujifilm products and the company and everything about the cameras. And I don't know why we didn't do it, actually, 3 years ago. A round of applause, please, for Andreas, and welcome to the Fujicast!
The Fujicast.
Here we are at the House of Photography in London, in very trendy Covent Garden, London. And it's very nice to be back here again. We haven't been here for a while, so it's absolutely fantastic to be here with our live audience who've attended our special event today. I should probably, as I said right at the start of the day, address the elephant in the room, and I don't mean to use that in the same sentence as talking about Kev, but Kev, unfortunately, was taken, well, quite ill, actually, this morning. He phoned me at 10 o'clock. Everybody was due to arrive at 11. I was trying to park my car in the rain. It was a very strange conversation, but unfortunately, Kev has been really quite ill. And we took him back to, Marlborough, I think, and he's currently taking a cocktail of whatever he can to make himself feel better. This is our way of getting him along to the docks to at last sort out his foot in his leg. So Kevin sadly isn't with us, but standing in for him today...
Sitting
in for him is Andreas Georgiadis.
Thank you, Neil.
Yeah, and it's very nice to have you here. Thank you very much for being our co-presenter today. I think it's gone well today.
So far, so good. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Can only go one place. Yeah.
Well, I have to sort of wind you into the thing as well. I don't think
wind
so.
Wind me up or...
No. Well, you know what it's like with Kev. When I start and it takes a little bit, about 10 minutes until I think, oh, Kev's with us.
So probably wind me down to just get me to the right level of grumpiness.
I don't write this stuff, Kev. I really don't.
He is missed.
He is missed, very much. All joking aside, we've really missed him today. And I'm looking forward to him being back on the show in a couple of weeks' time. But here we are, House of Photography. What we do when we do these gigs is, this really is a programme that's, it's not about myself and Kev or myself and Andreas, it's an opportunity for those that are in the audience to ask questions about Fujifilm cameras or anything to do with the creativity of being a photographer. We've had two fabulous talks today, one from Bal or Mr. Whisper. Bal, am I allowed to call you? I wonder whether I'm allowed to call you Bal or is it like a trade secret or something?
No, yeah, you can call me whatever feels comfortable. Bow, Mr. Whisper.
Well, see, I've followed your work for so long that you've always been Mr. Whisper to me. And when you told me your name, I thought, I can't call him that. That's like, I can't call him Bal. It's like, you know, he's Mr. Whisper to me.
Is there a backstory to Mr. Whisper as a name?
Oh, good question.
Yes, there is, actually. So Mr. Whisper was born from back in my creative days of being a graffiti artist.
Oh.
So Mr. Whisper is a name that I held until art college. And then once I stopped doing graffiti and social media started, I didn't really want to put my real name on the internet, so I stuck with Mr. Whisper. And yeah, it's just kind of tagged along the whole photography journey with me and turned into a bit of a brand, which was a nice surprise.
I've got to ask you a question. Did you ever get in lots of trouble for graffiti anywhere in particular?
I did, and that's why I stopped.
I really wanted to extend that question, but we won't. I can see that look in Bal's eyes. And also Emily Renier has been with us today, the latest of the ex-photographers. Ambassadorial position, obviously, within Fujifilm. They're called ex-photographers. I want to ask a question, actually, about that in a moment. I'll come to you, Andres, on that one. But you were talking about authenticity today, which I found fascinating. Who found that fascinating, by the way?
Yeah.
I really, really thoroughly enjoyed it. Just talk us through what your talk was. Obviously, if you weren't here, you didn't get the advantage of hearing what a fantastic talk. Yours was good as well, Mr. Whisper. But no, tell us what that was about, because I think it surprised some people in terms of you know, you might expect when you're listening to photographers, it's going to be about the photography, but yours was very much about the mental health aspect of photography.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, I think when you all start anew somewhere in a different industry, you can be very insecure, and I have been very insecure, and it's trying to put everything on the same level playing field and basically being authentic in a sense of saying, this is what I found difficult. Maybe some of you find it difficult too. And talking authenticity in itself, actually emulating authenticity in itself is really difficult. So if we all say it's difficult, then actually we can all share the same fears and doubts, and that makes the learning journey much easier, I think.
It was interesting that you said during your talk, you mentioned the fact that if anybody's new in the audience to photography or maybe going professional in photography, that this was for you, you know, when you were talking about authenticity and what it means and what it is. And I was looking at photographers that are professional, that have been doing this a while. And I think there was a penny dropping thing and it certainly was for me, in this idea that what is authenticity? Because for some people, authenticity is acting a bit like a ninja photographer. But that's not what you meant, was it?
No, I think basically authenticity to me is, who am I in this precise moment? What do I need to do for myself creatively, but for my bride and groom, for their own journey, and all my parents or the clients that I'm working with? How does that translate in the photos that I take? That's, for me, authenticity. It's keeping to my own meaning for that moment. How I do it, then it doesn't matter. It's the experience that I'm giving myself and the clients that I work with.
Is there a secret to authenticity? Is there sort of a, you know?
No, I think it's all our own. Can we call it authenticity source? Like, we all have our own.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. With you, Bal, there's, I suppose, authenticity plays into your work as well, doesn't it? Of course, because you are a street photographer. And for some people, they would think, well, street photography, that's got to be very, very candid. Nothing can be preconceived or pre-designed. But you talked at great length about the importance of a plan, didn't you?
Yes. So I think there's a fine line. Authenticity, of course, is really important with street photography, based on all the kind of legacy that comes with it about, you know, capturing that decisive moment, et cetera, et cetera. However, you know, I think when you're, like you said, when you were in Africa shooting with the children in a school and asking for permission made everything much easier, but still kept it authentic. Mm. So for me, there are times on the street where I might see a really interesting person and I just have to get their portrait. And at that moment, I will go and ask them for a shot and stage them in a way that I see them, you know, which is the way that I had it in my mind's eye. So if I wanted them, like, kind of running for a bus and they're up for it, they'll do it. So I think there's a fine line between the authenticity and capturing that candid moment. But ultimately, it should be your creativity that drives the final example or whatever your photo is.
There's a wonderful example of this with Don McCullin. I don't know if you've seen the film. He made it for Canon, actually, I think it was. And he went to a city in India, and he was photographing on the street. And it was interesting. I think of Don as somebody who, you know, hides in the shadows. I mean, he's 6 foot, whatever he is. He's, you know, probably finds it harder to hide in the shadows. But the interesting thing of watching him work was he constantly talked to the people he was photographing. Constantly was, Mr., over here, wasn't it?
That's exactly, in fact, when I mentioned him earlier, that's the film that I had in mind, and that's what I watched, you know, a few months ago. It's his engagement with people.
Right, questions. So we're going to go to the floor. Andres, just very quickly, ex-photographer. Why was it ex-photographer? Because it does, in our language, it doesn't
isn't always sort of, why are they ex-photographers?
Yeah, because it always feels like you're an ex-photographer. Oh, you've given up now.
Yeah.
We've approached the joke before.
Is it?
Yeah.
No.
On the industry?
No.
No, it stems from X series, and then we do a lot of things that have X in the title. So yeah. Ex-photographer comes from X series.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right, questions. So let's see a show of hands in the audience for questions. And what I'm hoping, obviously, is some of the questions will be directed at our speakers that we've had today. And you'll probably learn through listening to the podcast today the sort of subjects that they were talking about by the questions asked and the answers that are received. Andreas is here as an expert for the camera side. So we've got cameras, we've got Emily, we've got Whisper, obviously talking about their styles of photography. Who's got the first question, please? Hands in the air.
Hi. Yes, with all the talk of authenticity and stuff, sometimes I find myself concentrating on the sort of technical, the minutiae, zooming into 100%, seeing the grain and all that stuff. How do you step out of that and just, because, you know, the thing we were discussing, you can let that go and look at a picture as a whole. You can't see all that stuff and all the minutiae. And, we're, you know, with Fujifilm developing greater and greater technology, you sort of get focused in on that and not on the authenticity and the vibe and the picture. So how do you have a problem with that, or does it just, is that who you are?
Do you mean as in how do I kind of balance the focus on technical stuff?
To the vibe.
I mean, ironically, I shoot in full manual, so and Kev always tells me off because he's like, well, you're just focusing on the wrong thing. But for me, it's a journey. I actually love shooting in manual because I love the journey and the process of it all and being in control. I guess when you shoot that many weddings and when you shoot families, you kind of anticipate moments. So you kind of know, well, in this environment, I'm going to need these settings. And it's just a tiny, tiny bit of an adjustment then on the moment. So with time and experience, you kind of learn how to anticipate a moment, kind of expose for the, you know, and compose at the same time. So it's the more experience you have, the more you're able to kind of get the balance between the two.
Bal?
So since starting with the X-T1, I've probably set up my camera the same way all the way through to the X-T5. You know, they're very simple settings. And then when I was given the new X-106 and asked about all the new technical stuff that had happened, I only had to kind of embrace the stuff that I was using on the X-T5, and I knew that this tool would be able to give me the images that I wanted. So for me, it was very liberating. It felt much like how I used to shoot with my mobile phone, not worrying about the technical side, going out, being able to just, I'm usually an aperture priority, so I'm just adjusting the aperture when I see the scene so that I'm protecting my highlights. And from there, it's, you know, stay out of the technical side and focus on
Do you guys ever sort of pixel peep and go, ooh, that's a bit this and that? You're just artists, aren't you?
No, it's just like, for me, literally, I've just put myself in the position of my clients, then they won't be doing that. And to be fair, I haven't got the time. You know, I'm dealing with thousands of files, so I don't have the time to go into that much detail.
What do your clients say? Are your clients ever saying, oh, that image is a bit noisy, or the colours aren't great? They're not. The camera is, in essence, a tool, and you need to have confidence in that tool that it will give you the results that you need. So taking my Fujifilm hat off and thinking from an industry perspective, ultimately what these guys are doing are delivering for their clients. So if you are looking at the technical side of it, is the autofocus quick enough, is the noise grainy enough, or what have you, then you're probably not focusing on what your clients' needs are. So yes, we make fantastic cameras, and over the past 10 years they've evolved and they've changed, but ultimately all they should be doing is making your life easier to get the results that your clients need. Or if you're a hobbyist or enthusiast, just giving you that feeling and enjoyment when you're taking that picture.
Thank you for the question. I didn't ask your name, that was very rude.
Simon.
Thank you, Simon. Right, let's go for another question here, right at the back over there.
My name's Jeremy.
Don't say it like that. That's very... That's the wrong podcast, Jeremy.
It's a question initially directed at Bal or Mr. Whisper, but I want to ask Emily as well as you, Neil, yourself. It's kind of a bounce off the technical fantasticness that we have in cameras nowadays, that we can pretty much stick it in P mode or whatever, automatic mode, and as Kevin would say, or P for professional. How much of your work, and you alluded to this earlier on, Val, was how much of it is post-process? And I don't mean Photoshop. How much do you kind of post-process? I don't need to know the workflow, but how much of it is post-process and how much of it is, for example, straight out of camera? I get a bit guilty about not taking stuff straight out of camera. As good as it is.
You feel guilty or you...
Yeah, I kind of feel guilty that maybe...
But you should be working it harder, you mean, as an image?
In other words, I'm not a particularly good photographer if I don't have a straight out of camera shot.
Right, yeah? Okay.
I take it into whatever I take it into and nerd over it.
Right.
Not pixel peep, but just get it in the right colour, the right whatever else it is. So that was the question. How much of it is in post-process?
So because I shoot a lot at night, I purposely shoot kind of underexposed. And that's because I know when I go into post-production, I'll be able to pull out some of the darkness or the shadows from the image and the blacks. But if I'm overexposed, I won't be able to save anything that's been blown out. So for me, the post-process will probably be about 80% out of the camera, 20% in post-production. And what I'm doing in post is simply doing the kind of basic adjustment, so exposure, highlights, and shadows. And then I move on to the color grading, because for me, the color grading is where I kind of give my work a visual identity. So I can make the blues my own, reds my own, everything in the color palette my own. Now, something I discovered early on in my career, where I'd say post-production was probably, it was more like the real photo was 40% and then 60%, because I was still learning. I didn't know why aren't these things properly exposed at night? And through that, what I was finding is that the images were really nice. However, they were very surreal. It wasn't what my eye was seeing at the time. And so I was pulling things out of the black that I couldn't see. So it would have a very kind of surreal look. And now, like I said, I have very kind of basic settings. I don't really try to go over 3,200 ISO, because I find if I'm shooting above that, it's something that my naked eye can't see. And I'm just going to be creating something that people won't really recognize. So for me, it's really kind of important to get the best I can out of the camera, obviously, as we all do, and try and keep the post-production at a minimum. If I'm in a situation and I suddenly have to pull the ISO much higher, I'll walk away because there's not enough natural light for me to work with. So those are kind of my own rules that I stick to in order to make sure the photos I produce are as photorealistic as possible, but also have a visual style, which is part of my kind of personal marketing, you could say.
Emily.
Basically, I try and keep my processing to a bare minimum as well, especially for my colour. I think it's interesting the point you made, Jeremy, about being a good photographer and delivering a good photograph. I often see a direct correlation between a really excellent shot that I've done and the least amount of processing I need to add, because essentially you're getting the story and the composition to talk for itself rather than the editing. So when I look at my work, the more confident I've become with it, the least amount of processing I've had to add to it. But yeah, essentially my work is my own preset that I've kind of developed over the time, which is literally just a little bit of contrast and a little bit of clarity, and that's it. Because ultimately I think that what I don't want to do is to impose something of too much of me now that my bride and groom and parents are going to have in 20, 30 years to come, and that fad will have moved on. I want to make something as timeless as possible.
A question I probably would have posed to Kevin at this point is, how protective do you get over your look? Bal, you have a particular look in your photographs, and I know that Kev, presets are a really important part of his business. And the workflow within his business. What about you? I mean, in producing your looks and sharing them, how do you feel about that? Would you do it? Are you happy to do it? Are you confident enough to do it?
What do you mean? Share my presets?
Yeah, share your presets. I mean, this is the way that I do it, so I'm going to...
I mean, I don't mind sharing anything that I do, because ultimately I think that I'd like to think that the reason my couples choose me is because of the connections we have rather than anything else. So if people want to know how I do something, then I'm happy to share it.
I guess I'm talking more about photographers here who might say, look, I love Emily's stuff. I want mine to look like that.
Yeah.
Can I buy your presets?
Yeah, but I don't think my preset is any special enough to sell. So maybe that's an element of confidence. Yeah.
Well,
I don't sell my preset at all, no. It's something I've worked on for quite a long time, and it's given me an individual look. It also hindered my career for a very long time. The book that I mentioned, I've been working on that for 4 years.
Please give it a plug, give it a plug, go on.
One more. Oh, London After Dark coming out, Q4, Christmas, get it in every store available.
We'll do a link. Very good. Let's get that in at least twice more.
Okay, that's not going to be difficult. So, but, you know, over that journey, I didn't like the look of my photos. I had about 50 presets to choose from, and I was going up and down, and there was no consistency with the book. So I have simplified my whole workflow. I now have one preset, which I put on every photo, and then I tweak, as I said, the basic adjustments and the color grading, and then that's it. I want to keep that part as simple as possible.
Yeah.
I think one other trouble that you can fall into, like earlier in my career, was I used to love putting a blue tint over everything. Very fashionable. However, I remember the first time I received an orange car to shoot, I was like, how am I going to do this with an orange tint? Can I have a blue car, please? No. So it was at that point I realized you really need to respect the whole color spectrum and be sure that you're embracing all of them.
Yeah, I mean, from our perspective, film simulations and color profiles are something is our bread and butter. So we'd always look to adding more, and we are going to be adding more to some of the cameras in the springtime. We have been asked whether or not we'd ever sell film simulations to older cameras, but I think it's a very muddy path going down that route, and it's not something that I think that we would ever want to do.
No. The new Riella Ace, I mean, it's not new because it's been in the GFX, hasn't it? But that's one of the new profiles, colour profiles in the X100 VI, isn't it?
Yeah, so X100 VI has got the new Riella Ace. At the same time, we announced that it's coming to XH2S, XH2, XT5 and XS20 in the spring.
Yeah.
So we will be bringing that form simulation to the other fifth generation cameras. But if anyone's got any requests in terms of film simulations, the engineers are always listening out. So please share with the Fujicast peeps, and we can definitely do a poll or something and work out what we should be focusing on next.
I think polls a great idea for that. Yeah, we'll do that on the program, definitely. Jeremy, sorry, you wanted to come back with a question.
So there's a... This is a quick fire. So, Mr. Whisper, Emily, presets. Fuji do fantastic presets. We're in the House of Photography. Based either on today or this week, because your minds might change, what's your favourite current preset straight out of camera?
Ooh. Acros for me.
Same.
Thank you, Jeremy. Perfect. Right. Who else has got a question here?
My name is Dan.
Dan, hi.
I have a question and... about wedding photography and like a Fuji shooter, I find very frustrating when we're looking for jobs, like a second shooter, because we just started, they said Canon shooter, Sony shooter. Is any chance to have probably from Fuji or from you, like Fuji ambassadors, chance to show them our cameras is good? Because first thing, they don't ask for our work, they ask Canon shooter.
Oh, I see. Canon. So
I'm sorry about my...
No, not at all. I've got it. The question you're being asked is, can we have a Canon shooter or can we have a Nikon shooter or Sony shooter? And you know, that's the question that's being asked, yeah?
Like a Fuji users, we are like, oh, what's wrong with my camera or with my skills? Why they ask just for Canon?
Yeah. I think this is actually a question for Andreas as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's definitely an educational piece that needs to be done. There's a snobbery in some elements of the industry in terms of you're not professional enough if you're not using a Canon or Nikon. That's definitely the case in years gone by in, say, the red carpets, the press, and those sorts of areas. There needs to be more work from our side, and part of that is building up the reputation of our ex-photographers and highlighting the fact that you can... It's the person, not just the equipment, that's important. And I would argue, from your perspective, if anyone ever challenges you and say you have to be using Canon or Nikon, I think you should be saying to them, judge me on my work,
yes,
not my equipment. Because my eye is my eye, how I shoot is how I shoot, but I'll definitely take that on board in terms of how we can do more to raise the profile of the brand to be seen as professional for all types of genres.
Bao, I think it was very interesting listening to you talking, and you, there was one particular moment where you were discussing some of the jobs that you've done in the, well, the world of Hollywood, I suppose, and you were walking into these rooms with an XT1. How did you feel walking into some of these high-profile environments with an XT1?
I thrived on it, actually. I enjoy being the underdog in scenarios, and it was probably one of the reasons I went with Fujifilm in the first place. I thought it has everything that I need within the camera, and it can deliver the level of images and whatever my clients require. So there was no nervousness with the brand. I knew that it could deliver. I think instead what worked in my favor was, you know, the actual aesthetic of the camera. You know, it's a very beautiful looking camera. And it's helped me break the ice with lots of my very nerve-wracking photo shoots with Hollywood people.
Who was that actor you were talking about that said, "Oh, is that an analog camera?" Who was it again?
It's the guy who plays Pablo Escobar in Narcos.
Ah, yes.
Only had 5 minutes, but the other two shooters were shooting with other brands, Canon and a Sony, I believe. But when I pulled up with my XT1. It immediately broke the ice. He jumped off his seat. He was like, "Oh, is that an analog camera?" I was like, "Have a go with it." And at that moment, I was allowed to take him out of the studio and get some shots that everyone else couldn't.
Which so. They didn't with their Canons. Emily, did you want to add something to that? I saw you nodding your head furiously in terms of choosing a camera that... I mean, you purposefully chose Fujifilm after watching Kevin actually talk, didn't you?
I did. But basically, the reason why is because I couldn't get my head round, I'm just going to be honest, with the exposure triangle with the Nikon. And then Kevin said, "Well, I should Fujifilm." Went to get 2 days later my first Fujifilm with the X-T2 with a kit lens. And then completely empowered. And then that gave me confidence to learn about the exposure triangle. And now I'm confident with it. But I just needed that confidence building to begin with.
And we'll return to the House of Photography very soon. At this point, we'd like to thank our sponsors, PicTime, for supporting the show. PicTime's platform offers the finest online gallery space, which for photographers wanting to show their clients slick, beautiful, feature-rich galleries from which you can upsell product, is vital. Both Kev and I use PicTime to show our clients photo shoots and weddings following their events, but you can use it for all kinds of photography, including landscape and commercial work. And the idea that you can find suppliers to fulfill orders of anything from prints to albums to even specialist promotional gear with your brand associated is something that has been important to both our businesses. Elevate your photos with a built-in print store with powerful marketing automation tools, so you can be as hands-on or hands-off if you want in terms of the next part of the sales process. So go to pic-time.com, and if you'd like to use them yourself, just enter the word FUJICAST in caps to receive 1 month free of charge. Thank you, Big Time, for being the perfect partner to our podcast and the perfect partner to our businesses when it comes to displaying our photographs after a shoot. Right, back to the House of Photography for part two. Right, let's go for another question. Who have we got in the audience? Put your hands up, please, all the way over there.
Hi, I'm John. Fujifilm cameras are, for various reasons, it seems, often associated with street photography for all the best reasons. You know, the X100 range, perfect for street photography. I use my X-T5s in a studio environment with off-camera strobes, and... it's what really puzzles me, I suppose it's for you, Andreas, really, is I never seem to see Fujifilm cameras kind of marketed in that way. And I've even had a few people say to me, "Oh, you know, it's really hard to get a Fujifilm camera to work with off-camera flash." I mean, personally, I've never experienced that. I have to go to third-party suppliers for things like flash sort of triggers and that. Do you not think is it a bit of a missed marketing opportunity, or because I mean, I find with the X-T5s in particular, that extra resolution is absolutely stunning for, you know, for studio work.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I think that for many years, Fujifilm, when we launched the X-Pro1, was definitely street, family, travel. And that's been our comfort zone. And slowly we've expanded as we've increased resolution into the landscapes, the sort of like the portraiture, the studio sessions. Flash has never been our strong point, and we've always tried to work as closely as possible with third parties. But you're right. I mean, a comment that Bal made about being the underdog, and we definitely see ourselves sometimes like that in the industry, and third party support for software and Flash and other accessories hasn't always been as quick, but we're definitely working closer with accessory manufacturers and things like that to make sure that we are developing things quicker. But in terms of your point, why isn't Fujifilm seen as much in the commercial sphere? I think that that's what the GFX system did for us. It opened up that door, definitely fashion, portraiture, commercial, definitely for GFX. So we probably focus, we market that side of things for GFX, but you are 100% correct that we should also be doing just as much for XH2, XT5 with that additional resolution. So it's a fair comment and one I'll take back to the rest of the marketing team.
I know you can't run a business on the concept of being a romantic brand, but that romance does sort of play into it with being an underdog, or am I wildly off kilter here?
No, I think that part of the charm of Fujifilm is that we're all passionate about photography to start with. We are all very approachable. We have the house photography. Theoretically, anyone can come in and ask somebody from Fujifilm anything at any time because we're here, and we like to make ourselves the face of Fujifilm, I suppose. I'm here on this podcast. We'll be all at the photography show, and sort of like you'll be speaking to the marketing team, the product specialists and what have you. So we are romantic in that we like being that sort of underdog. We don't like being that sort of like mass volume brand. I suppose the money makers, the accountants, the salespeople would be kicking me right now.
They would, no, yeah.
But yeah, that's part of the charm of Fujifilm, I believe, in terms of just the fact that we do make ourselves available. We do like to know our customers as much as possible on a first name basis, and that.
These questions are great, by the way. Keep them coming. We've got a little bit more time on the show, so let's go into the audience just over there. There we go. Fantastic. Your name, please.
Ashton.
Hi, Ashton.
I'd just like to ask Andreas in particular just a little bit more insight into the licensing process between third-party lens manufacturers and the Fujifilm X system. Like, how does that work? Just to get a little bit of, because I have no idea, and I use a lot of third-party glass, and I'm just wondering how that works.
What's your favorite piece of third-party glass?
The Viltrox 75mm f1.2.
Okay. Lovely. Very nice.
So I'm going to stumble my way through this because I'm not privy to the exact details of how that works in Japan. The engineers and the product planners in Japan will manage that relationship. As I understand it, we make our mount available to anyone that would like to make lenses for it. We've got two sort of like sides of that. You've got the Chinese manufacturers who will make very manual glass, no electrical contacts and things like that. And then you've got the latest iterations from the likes of Viltrox, Sigma, the Tamrons of this world. So we've said before, our management have said before rather, that we are quite happy to work with third parties to make lenses. The challenge that we have is when you end up having 40 lenses of your own, and the third party needs to do one of two things: either make a better lens optically, which is a challenge, or make it cheaper, or do something else. And the chances of them finding a niche in terms of a focal length that we don't have in our range is a bit of a challenge. I think Viltrox have got a 75mm 1.2 or a 1.4 and a 27. Yeah. So what they've tried to do is like, right, we'll go faster, we'll use a similar focal length, or we'll use something completely different. So that's always the challenge with Sigma, on the other hand, when we're going to nail exactly the focal lengths that most people want, 16, 30, and 56. But we can't make them optically superior, or we're not going to try and compete with them optically superior, or we're going to make them cheaper, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think third-party glass is great. It opens up the system to a much wider range of people. And if anything, it might be the gateway drug into buying one of our more premium and professional lenses. But the exact process of how long it takes, who gets involved and things like that, it's not information I'm privy to, unfortunately.
Will the GFX system ever open up to third-party glass? Because that would be pretty amazing if it did, and then make it a lot more versatile as well.
The challenge with GFX is the resolution. You need to be 100 megapixel plus, and there's only a few manufacturers that can make glass that good. So I think that's why people have been slow to uptake. There have been a few manual lenses coming through from Laowa, I believe. I don't know exactly how to pronounce that. They've made GFX, native GFX lenses, but I think that's the main challenge and why other people. I think Sigma at CP Plus last week said they'd like to be considered a premium lens manufacturer, and if to do that they need to make GFX or medium format. So I'm paraphrasing now, but it's an article I read last week. So I think more the merrier. As you say, it opens up the system, it improves the versatility. With the GFX system, it's probably easier because there are a lot more focal lengths that aren't done. But the challenge you have is you need to make sure that glass is top-notch. Yeah. It's probably one of the reasons why you haven't got as many adapted lenses being used on GFX, because you haven't got the resolution for it.
Thanks for your question. Right, let's go for another one. Let's go along the front here and come to it. It's Peter. I know Peter.
So I don't have to say my name?
No.
Okay.
Well, you are one of our esteemed helper-outerers, so I'm not sure that's an official title, but...
Not sure how I feel about that, but okay. This question is basically for Andreas. You said before that the development of Fuji cameras is moving in the direction where they should make our lives as photographers easier. I'm assuming that a big part of the market for you is amateur photographers still. So I'm wondering, will we ever see phone-like features in Fuji cameras? As in
making
waving
calls
to the lens to make it make a selfie, direct access to Instagram, whatever, stuff like that.
So we have often talked about that internally, about making smartphone functionality, whether or not you go down an Android platform and things like that. And thankfully, from an industry perspective, Samsung already tried that, weren't really, they gave up in terms of dedicated cameras. Do I envisage more smartphone-like functionality coming? Probably. I think that the different question would be, you look at the trend in the past 18 months, 2 years, in terms of people's acceptance of film photography, the film simulations and things like that, and it's how do we evolve that to appeal to a mass audience? People aren't really asking us for functionality akin to a smartphone, but we do need to make things like uploading directly to the internet a lot quicker, a lot easier. And other functionality that makes people feel and enjoy the process of using a dedicated camera better. So part of the reason why the X100 series has been so successful is the look, the feel, the ergonomics, and people are quite happy to carry a separate device with them. So I'm not sure. I think it will merge, but we'll always want to keep something unique photographically rather than be like the wave to the camera and those sorts of gimmicks. We did a lot of that when we were making compact cameras. And I think that we still want to be seen as enthusiasts, so encourage new people to the system, but not at the risk of making too many gimmicks. Mm.
Let's pass that microphone along the way to another one of our esteemed helper-outerers.
I'm not sure how I feel about that either.
Steve.
Hi, guys. Just following on from Peter's question, really, and to Andreas again. So you gave a great talk on the X100. And as you said, it's the sixth iteration. It's been going for 12 years.
Yep.
How far do you see that concept going into the future, though? I mean, will we be sitting here in 10 years' time with the X100-10 with the same body, same design, or will it eventually, do you think, run its course?
I suppose the wider question is how long do dedicated cameras have? I think that from our perspective, we have plans sort of like several years in the future. We have a technology roadmap. We'd like to, we understand where processor and where sensor technology is going. I think there will, the great thing that we've got going for us is this sort of like, the X100 series has broken the mold in terms of appealing to enthusiast professionals and also lifestyle. So a lot of people we know like it as a fashion accessory. I think the more we can do to encourage people to take photographs and print them and everything, the longer longevity we have. So do I envisage us still being here in 10 years' time? Yes. What iteration of the X100 would it be? Carry the one. Probably 10. So, yeah. What it will be called, I don't know. If we've gone for letters or numbers by then. But yeah, we have no plans to stop making cameras. We've got a very healthy roadmap for the rest of the year in both cameras and lenses. Firmware updates, obviously, as we've already touched upon. So that's our challenge. How do we keep on making sure that cameras stay relevant? Part of Peter's question in terms of the functionality, making sure it's easier to make sure we've got the next generation of people taking pictures on dedicated devices. And part of the charm of Fujifilm is we've got that we've got the Instax generation who are helping doing that. We're trying to appeal to a wider audience through various printing solutions and things like that. But yeah, cameras is definitely something I hope so. I don't plan to retire in 10 years.
No. Actually, I'm sorry to do this, but we might as well have the trinity, it's probably not holy, of the helper outer as Neil. I'm sorry, Neil, to throw you sort of under the bus with this particular one, but we did have a conversation that you felt that the X100 was going to become perhaps the X200. But why did you come up with that thought?
Only because if you've seen Fuji released a cut or the photographs of the X100 VI cut in half, it is so packed. I mean, it's an incredible piece of engineering, but it looks like it's reaching the limits of what's possible in that body size. Yeah, yes, things get better, things get smaller, chips are getting thinner, but there is still physics still comes into it. So there is a, it looks like, and one of the things is it's still using the 126 battery because best people in the world, trying to cram the 235 into that size of a case, you'd need a TARDIS. So my thought was, it's getting to the point where at some point it might morph into the X200 because they're going to have to change some of the ergonomics to fit what they next want to do. Because it's so well built, it's so well made, but you couldn't get a fag paper in there. It's that tight. You know, you look at it and you think, no, because I...
No, he hasn't.
Andreas
hasn't
won't give
out.
Me one to cut in half.
No. See,
understandably.
It's my fault.
That was my thought, is that I just can't... I'd love to be proven wrong.
I think that's a fair comment. I think that having spoken to the engineers and the designers last week, his ethos is he wanted to keep the look and feel exactly the same. The quote I heard was, from 3 meters away, you shouldn't be able to tell which X100 it is. So personally, I don't think they would ever want to do anything to change the character of the look of the camera or the aesthetic. That is a challenge for a couple of years' time. I hope we're both proven wrong and we can have that conversation at the Fujicast, what would it be, 6th birthday, 7th birthday,
yeah,
or something like that?
Yeah, we'll still be here.
Yeah.
Right, let's see if we've got some more questions in the audience here. Right, to the front row here. What's your name, sir?
Hi, I'm David.
David.
Can I first request that when you come to name the episode, you put some of Neil's quote about the TARDIS or cigarette rolling paper? That'd be a good clickbait.
That's a good one, I like that.
I was mainly going to say I'm not an X100 user, mainly because 35mm was kind of like my go-to focal length. But I am, however, I have been drawn to it, like with the megapixel upgrade, and the fact that you can put a tele converter and make it into a 35, essentially. But if you were to put a X-T5 with a 35mm lens on the table next to a X-100 VI with a tele converter, how would they compare to each other if it was...
Good question.
Same megapixel, but...
So same megapixel, but obviously you're using one lens which is designed to be a 35mm.
Yeah.
And you're using a 23mm plus a teleconverter, and as soon as you use any sort of converting lens, you're getting some sort of compromise. So the character of the X100 is that it's that 23, it's that always that small. So if you said, I want to shoot 35mm or 50mm equivalent, then I'm always going to tell you, get an X-T5 with a 33mm f1.4 or the 35mm if you want that look, that feel. Optically, I think that would be a superior combination. X100 VI or X100 series with that 23mm, so 35mm equivalent, is designed to be slightly different in terms of look. Personally, I use an XS20 with a 23mm, the original 23mm. Going back to Neil's point, it's because of the battery. So, it's horses for courses. So I will compromise on the look of the product in terms of the camera and the handling, because I prefer to have a larger battery in the system. The 23 mil doesn't change from my XS20, but it's just horses for courses.
Thanks for the question. Right, let's move the microphone around. Let's go to the back first, and then we'll come across. That's a good idea.
Hi, Paul Gallagher. My question's for Mr. Whisper Bal. I'm a budding street photographer, and I kind of listened with interest when you had talked about you always go out with a brief, even with kind of doing street photography. I mean, I guess sometimes I have some projects in the back of my mind, but then sometimes I'm equally just wandering aimlessly. I wonder if you could expand on your kind of thought process behind, you know, how you come up with these briefs, and is it kind of a project-based thing, or you know, what are you thinking about in that sense?
Sure. So, like I said, it can be incredibly overwhelming when you step out onto the streets because there's so much to shoot. So, yeah, my first point of call before going out is building that small little brief, and that can be something that I'm coming up with just on the day. That's something I've seen on TV, in a magazine, or on Instagram that's inspired me. And so I'll follow that theme, be it a colour, landmark, or a particular item of clothing, like a hat or something. That's one stream of thought which is going on. Then secondly, I have lots of projects over the years which have built up. So lots of different passion projects of like people meeting and greeting outside tube stations, people inside taxis doing interesting stuff. So those are always like on the sideline. So it's important to have lots of kind of passion projects in the background, as well as like that daily theme with you. And then also there's all the, you know, the stuff that the streets are going to throw at you, which you need to be prepared for as well. Can be overwhelming, but also it's good to have these little briefs to help you just stay focused when you're out there.
Thanks, Bal. Brilliant. Right, we've got somebody at the back. How many more questions have you got, by the way? Okay, we're going to rattle through these, make sure we get these all done.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm Greg. I've got a question for Neil this afternoon relating to sound. Now, I do video and enjoy the video aspect of it. I do the photo as well. I still enjoy I enjoy the video a little bit more than the photo, but one problem I have with the video is choosing what backing music to use. I can spend hours and hours listening to music and still not have a choice of backing music to use. And the second question is, how important do you consider the sound in a production that involves sound? Is it a very important thing?
Or is it not so important? Well, I'll answer the second question first, if you don't mind, and I'll give an example of in my broadcast career where we were, I won't mention the name of the artist, it was a big artist, and we were in Bucharest to cover this artist's first big gig since the state went from communism to independent rule. And they'd never had a big pop concert before. And so we went across, I was a presenter on that particular concert. And radio, I suppose, I mean, I'm sure radio people would argue with this, but it was considered almost the sort of the poor relation of maybe to television. But on that particular production, there was a guy that was in charge of radio and telly. His job was to bring this concert, and I'm going to use language which I'm going to have to bleep out, but I'm going to use it so that you hear it, because it was what he said. On this particular concert, there was a guy that was in charge that was both for radio and television. The head honcho, executive producer, director, if you like, over the whole thing. Anyway, we met for breakfast in the what was bullet-riddled Intercontinental Hotel at that time. And he said, he got up, he was the first one to do a talk, and radio was one side, television the other side, never the twain shall meet usually, and he said, look, he said, big concert today, I want you to know one thing and remember this. And he was the television guy, this was a television guy. He said, you can f*** up the pictures, but don't you dare f*** up the sound. And the point he was making was very sound, in that people will forgive the odd picture going a bit awry, but they won't forgive sound being wrong. I mean, how many times have you watched a television program or film and you've thought, oh dear, the sound's awful? Not many times, because professional sound recordists will make sure that even if it's a dodgy-ish kind of scene, that sound is absolutely spot on. In terms of music,
Well, it's a lot, very long-winded process. I spend a lot of time listening to music. Most of that is from, my favorite at the moment is Artlist. As a supplier, I think artlist.io, I think it is, are absolutely phenomenal. I love their licensing model as well, in that you can use that music for your projects and you can use it for third-party clients as well. That gives you a lot of scope to use music. That doesn't quite, though, answer your question about how do you choose it. That, I'm afraid, is a long-winded process. You have to do a lot of listening. I actually listen to Artlist if I can download and stream it. I listen to it in the car. And I listen to it a lot in the house as well when I'm just doing stuff. It's the only way you can do it. I put it into, you know, on Artlist, how you, I think you use Artlist, don't you? Because we had a conversation about it. You use it, don't you?
I do, yeah. I use Artlist.
Yeah. Well, you know how you can put it into playlists? Start making some playlists and title them. So you have, I don't know, wedding, portrait, rainy day. I mean, I'd really do drill down to that extent. Rainy day, sunny day, and so on and so forth. Yeah, yeah.
Grumpy,
yeah.
Yeah, spot on, thank you very much.
Yeah, I call that one Kevin. Kevin, I'm so sorry. He did send me a message, by the way, to say he's okay, he's in the house now, he's come back from the hospital, and...
Just checking, his own house, yeah?
His own house,
yeah. All right.
It is his own house. Right, let's go for another question here. Who have we got there?
It's a question for Neil. It would have been for you and Kev, but for obvious reasons. It's good to hear he's back at home and he's safe.
Yeah.
Over the probably hundreds of FujiCast episodes that have gone on, you've talked about cameras and updates to cameras and things you'd like to see. And I wonder if you've ever thought about reviewing your back catalogue to seeing how many of those have actually come true to fruition. And if they have you gone to Fujifilm to ask for your commission?
Are you talking about how many people have bought cameras since we mentioned them? Is that
no,
what you mean?
No, is it 300 episodes of FujiCast?
Yeah, 200 and something or other, isn't it?
You've talked about various cameras and things you'd like to see in cameras in the future going forward. And I think you've had...
How many of the features have come to fruition? Yeah. Oh, I don't know, really. I mean, we're not really... I mean, we have the running joke, don't we, that Kev often uses, which he'll say, you know, he's put forward this great idea and the people at Fujifilm will say, that's a cracking idea. They'll never say no, but they will say, we will consider.
So there are actually three levels of we will consider.
Oh, are there?
Yes.
Okay. How does this work then? Let me know.
So we will consider is not even going to bother. No chance.
Oh.
We will consider positively is... Oh, that's interesting. Right. Probably still never going to happen.
Right.
And then yes is the other one.
Oh, right.
So it's a Japanese culturally, they don't like saying no. And what have you.
Yeah.
So in answering to your question, I suppose that from our perspective, we don't see more sales when a firmware upgrade happens. There is a loyalty element. There's a giving back to the community. There's doing what's right. And I think I've had the conversation with Peter on social media before years and years ago about whether or not camera companies should do firmware updates. And I think from my perspective, when we were starting out and learning how to get the most out of a sensor and processor, probably we'd get 70% of the way there. And then now we're probably about 90% of the way there. And then when a camera is launched. So I love firmware updates. I love giving back to people. It's not something that we charge anyone for or anything like that. So the sense of paying a commission to people for ideas, it's almost like in many ways I would say that people should buy a camera for the features that it has, not for the features that it could have.
There's always going to be a desire list though and a wish list.
There's always going to be a desire list. Yeah, yeah, 100%. And so there's always that balancing act as well. So I think from our perspective, we have committed to doing firmware updates. It's gone from there were used to be loads, and now there's fewer, as I said, primarily because we know more at the start of the process what to do. But we're always listening in the nicest possible way.
I think you are. I think that would be a fair thing to say about Fujifilm. To answer your question, I don't think anything that I've ever asked for or suggested has ever been taken on board. But then I'm never have been an ex-photographer, so it's unlikely to. Kev, I think, has had some moments where people have sat up and said, you know what, Marlins, that's not a bad idea. I think he's had a bit of success, hasn't he?
Yeah, we've taken Kevin to Japan and had
conversations with the designers and the product planners, and it's always the meetings after the meetings that are the more productive when the secret squirrel sort of like sketches come out and engineers are saying what is and what isn't possible and that sort of stuff. So yeah, we've always had an open dialogue with our ex-photographers. Other people can contribute, and I do read the FujiCast feed, and we do take ideas back, and we report back on a quarterly basis, suggestions. The challenge is always resources, and people have to say, right, am I going to develop a firmware update, or am I developing a new camera? And unfortunately, the bean counters say, new camera will get me more sales.
Yeah.
And they don't think longer term sometimes about, well, actually continuously improving your current product will drive loyalty and make sure that people invest in the brand as well.
Right, there was a question through in the middle over here. Your hand was up. Yes.
Hello, my name is Daniel. And for about a year now, I've been doing the nightclub photography. I've been spending pretty much 90% of the weekends in the nightclub with my X-T5. And over that time, I've managed to assemble quite a decent portfolio of work. And I've gotten to a point that I was starting to think, how do I take it to the like next level? And I've noticed that there's not many ex-photographers that do like nightlife events. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I was thinking, and that's a question to Emily, because she's like one of the recent ex-photographers. Could you like briefly describe the process and requirements of becoming an ex-photographer?
The as far as I was just being myself, and then one day Fujifilm got in touch with me. So I didn't do anything. Yes, other than I've tagged Fujifilm into my photographs on social media, but that's about it.
So I think that probably going back to the other question about genres that we are comfortable and confident in terms of making people aware that our cameras are suitable for. So I think that's partly an internal question in terms of you don't see many event photographers or nightclub photographers shooting on Fujifilm. But the challenge that we have is, as a genre of photography, it's probably not the biggest genre of photography. So it's probably one that we overlook. In terms of the process of becoming an ex-photographer, it's about anything from an 18 to 24 month process. Not everyone that we work with can become an ex-photographer. Resource-wise, it's just not feasible. We've gone from, when I started at Fujifilm 8 years ago, having 50 people that called themselves ex-photographers. I culled that down to about 25. And then over the years, we've changed, chopped and changed and what have you. And I suppose the important thing is to differentiate what is someone who is an ambassador for the brand, i.e. somebody who promotes the brand themselves off their own back. And all of you who use Fujifilm and tag us on social media, you are ambassadors of the brand.
And yeah, very much.
Supporting us very much. And you can still be an ambassador without being an ex-photographer. So we do have a process in terms of people can register, fujifilm-collaborators.co.uk. There is an application process, but it's not a yes or no thing. So what would happen is, if we deem your work interesting, varied, worthy, we would reach out to you. We might say to you, can we feature you? Can you write a blog for us? Can you do a workshop for us? Can we? And it's like an 18, 24 month job interview. And it gets to a point where not everybody who does that will become an ex-photographer, because the scheme might not be right for you because of the rules that we in place and contractually what we require you to do. But yeah, there is an unwritten process. But yeah, from Emily's perspective, when she says she didn't do anything, she tagged us. She was an ambassador for us in terms of saying good things about us and what have you. We like the style of her work. And she said to us, if you get rid of Kevin, I'm available.
I told you not to say that. I told him not to say that.
But yeah, so if you go to the collaborators website, if you submit some work, we try and reach out to as many people as possible, but we have a very small marketing team and it's not always possible to speak to everyone. But yeah, be patient and, yeah, stick with it.
I've got a question. Just asking for a friend. Can a former ex-photographer come back into the fold again? Just asking for a friend.
Asking for a friend.
Right, let's have another question. I think we've only got time for maybe one or two more, and then any other questions can be asked in the pub when you get a far more honest answer, probably, if it's a really difficult question. I don't know, maybe. Right, who have we got there? Who's got the microphone?
I'm Simon. I've got a question for Emily, which is about family photography. So Neil talked earlier about some of the challenges for the wedding photography industry at the moment. And I just wondered, from your perspective, what does the family photography industry feel like? Is it growing? Is it shrinking? You talked to us about an approach to family photography, which is incredibly meaningful and valuable to the people that you're working with. So it's, in principle, something that people should really want to have, but it's not necessarily something they need to have in the same way as wedding pictures. So I'm just wondering how that feels at the moment.
That's a really good question. So my main clients actually now are the clients that booked me a few years ago and their families that are stuck with me. Have I got more, like, new families getting in touch with me this year compared to last year? No, but we are in February and the lead time for families is 2 to 6 weeks as opposed to 6 months to a year. So it could happen. In regards to the second part of your question, it is very much more of a push rather than a pull when it comes to family photography, because, like, it is a frustration from my point of view that I can't seem to tell the world out there what they're missing out on. I mean, it sounds boastful, but it's not meant to be, because when I'm talking to mothers and fathers and I'm showing them this is what I do for a living, they're sold instantly. It's just that I haven't got a medium to tell them that I can provide for them, because everything that people know about family photography is studio. If only I could shout out to all the parents out there, you don't need to go to a studio. Not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm not, because actually there's a lot of great work out there, studio work for family, but it'd be great if that could be like the default setting for family photography.
Right, last question of the show. Any more questions, then we will take into a very different studio.
Hi, I'm Steve. It's a very quick question for Mr. Whisper. I don't know if it's anything you've ever considered, Mr. Whisper, but would you think about perhaps bringing out a book of some of your photography?
What? Oh, this is like having a proper script writer. It really is. Mr. Whisper, have you ever thought about a book?
Fantastic question. I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I'm so happy to announce officially that it will be out this Christmas, online, in bookshops, everywhere. So keep your eyes out. It's called London After Dark.
Can we sell it here?
I really want you guys to sell it here.
So we will actually have an area in the shop for selling books.
So you'll be able to pick up London After Dark by Mr. Whisper in the House of Photography at Covent Garden. You heard it here first. Book signing, of course.
All right. Val, thank you very much, Mr. Whisper. Emily Renier, thank you very much. Andreas, thank you. What a great co-presenter. We could do this, more often. We could.
He'd kill me if I got rid of him from the Fuji cast as well as the photographer.
Anyway, thank you to our audience, our live audience here at the House of Photography. You've been absolutely fantastic. It's been a delight talking with you today. So thank you very much, House of Photography.
The Fujicast is an independent Loading Zone production. Email the show with your questions and words of wisdom to click@fujicast.co.uk. Email any complaints and political nonsense to our wives, who will deal with your comments in their own good time and in their own good way.